It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Today, the secret language of plants. Next time you go for a walk outside, take a look at everything that's green and growing, everything with leaves and roots and stems, and imagine that it's all secretly talking.
One can learn things from trees, plants, weeds, blades of grass. These are all actually our cousins.
Now, if you're not a plant scientist, this might sound kind of crazy, but in fact, there's a whole world of plant communication that biologists are just beginning to understand.
You know, I was trained as a forester, and when I went back to become a professor after I'd done quite a bit of this work, some of the older professors were going, "Don't listen to this. This doesn't, you know, this is, well, they use the word bull, right?" Now it's starting to be incorporated in mainstream high school textbooks.
Suzanne Simard has been part of a quiet revolution in our basic understanding of trees and forests. Working at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, she's discovered a whole web of underground communication between trees. To get a sense of what she's found, let's head to our local arboretum for a walk. Good spot?
This is fine, yeah.
Okay. What's your background? How did you get into forestry?
My family came from Quebec and moved across and settled in the inland rainforest of British Columbia, and my grandfather and my uncles all horse logged. Every summer we would spend in these cedar hemlock forests that were so rich and diverse and, you know, huge playgrounds for kids. That just became part of me. I mean, I think I was always wired for forests and wired for earth, so it's just a natural calling.
Let's walk in a little bit if we could. So when I've read popular articles or blog posts about your work, the headlines often say, "Trees talk." Do you think trees can communicate?
Yeah, absolutely. My work actually looks at one way that they communicate, and I think there's multiple ways, but I'll just talk about what I know. I look at how trees are connected below ground by these mutualistic fungi called mycorrhizal fungi.
Mycorrhizal fungi.
You can think of them as like extensions of the root system. The plant or the tree depends on that fungus to go out and explore the soil, and the fungus goes and explores and grows into all these little teeny tiny niches or accesses nutrients that are unavailable to the tree.
So is this like a secondary or subsidiary root system almost?
It is. In fact, if you think about how much is down there compared to the root system itself, under a single footstep in this forest, there would be hundreds of miles of a fungal network.
Wait, under a single footstep?
Under a single footstep.
Well, so what does this have to do then with whether trees can communicate with each other?
So the way that communication happens is that through these mycorrhizal networks that link tree after tree after tree, they send resources back and forth. So when I say resources, I mean things like carbon, nitrogen, phosphorus, water, defense signals even. So they all send resources or nutrients out to trees that might be struggling under stress. And so we've seen like the more shaded a tree is, the more a nearby tree that's in the sunlight will send to that shaded tree.
Well, the trees are helping each other?
Yeah, it really turns upside down how we've traditionally thought and managed forests. We still manage them to this very day on this competition model that they're individuals competing for resources. But what I have found is that they're all connected together and that they're sharing these resources. It doesn't mean competition's not going on as well, but there's a multiplicity of interactions.
So if any of us were to go walking in the woods, would you have to dig very far down
See... To see the network?
Yeah.
No, it's actually, we can do that now. Let's see if I can get some roots. You know, you get some root and you start looking at the root tips. When you see the little bulbous parts at the end?
Yeah.
See that
where
little
it kind of before it branches?
Yeah, it's more fleshy. That's fungal material that's wrapped around the root tip. And out of that, even though you can't see those mycelium, there's emanating hyphae that come out of that little root tip.
They're so beautiful when you look at them. I mean, sort of branching, they're like,
yeah,
I don't know, a combination of hair and coral.
Yes, I know they have beautiful branching patterns that we've hardly studied at all. And the fungi, when you go into like my forest, when you pull up a root system, the fungi are abundant and they're all different colors. Like each species has a different color. They have different shapes. Some of them have trilobate branching. Some of them have bifurcating branching, or they branch into two. And you can also, in forest at home, you can pull up this forest floor and see just big mats of fungal material underneath. It's like pulling off pages of a book. Literally, I can open up the forest floor and I can see these pages and pages of mycorrhizal fungal networks just right before me. It's incredible.
You've discovered a whole new world.
I have.
Some of your work has involved what you call mother trees. Can you explain what's a mother tree?
Yeah, so one of my graduate students, Kevin Beiler, and some other colleagues and I, we did this big study where we took a forest, Douglas fir forest, and we looked at all of the connections in the forest. So we were looking at two fungi, Rhizopogon vesiculosus and Rhizopogon vinicolor. I know that's a mouthful, but keep in mind there's like 100 other species of fungi in that forest. We looked at two. We found that every tree was connected to every other tree. And the bigger and older the tree, the more connected it was. So those trees we call the mother trees or hub trees. We called them mother trees because what we also found was that the young seedlings were regenerating within the network of the mother tree. And so it's just, you can think of this like a huge brain growing out through the forest from this single tree.
Yeah, because it sounds like neural networks, right?
Yeah, basically they're like neural networks. We've actually found that the patterning of the network is just the same as a neural network.
Now, I read that you said somewhere something about when a tree, like a mother tree, gets ready to die, it will deliberately pass its resources onto its children, I guess.
Yeah. So one thing we found is that we have this thing called kin recognition known in animal species. And now we're discovering that there's actually kin recognition between plants. And we've done some experiments to show that these mother trees will actually send more carbon to genetically related individuals than strangers. So that means that the mother tree is nurturing her young to pass on her genes to future generations. And then, okay, you asked about dying trees. So we know, and we're doing experiments with this in the beetle-killed forests of the north. You know, the management paradigm is to cut the dying trees. And we're trying to look at, and this is based on previous work done in grasslands, where when a tree starts to die and it knows it's going to die, it's on its way out, it will start shoveling carbon or sending its own carbon and nutrients to linked trees in its understory. So it's actually passing on what it has left to the next generation. And our studies are so simple. All we've measured is carbon and phosphorus, and we don't know if there's any other messages. And even if, you know, we can't figure out what those messages are, we know enough now that those trees are hugely important, those mother trees, or in Aboriginal cultures, they're called grandmother trees. We know that they're important for their genes, for what they pass on to their young, and what we're doing is we cut them out because we are trying to capitalize on the wood before they die so that we can sell it on the market. And to me, it's like a lost legacy. We're really cheating the ecosystem out of its natural healing power.
Well, it's a pretty powerful lesson in terms of resilience also, isn't it? I mean, I would think would apply to human beings too. And what, for the last decade or so, health researchers have proved what we all kind of know anecdotally, people who have strong social networks, friends, family, live longer, are healthier. Sounds like the same thing's true for trees.
It is true. So the more connected in those trees are, and the more diverse and locally adapted the community is. So the community that knows its own environment, the better off it's going to be. And, you know, I'll just tell you my own personal experience. I had breast cancer a couple of years ago. And, I mean, I'm doing great. But the thing that really got me through was my connections. You know, it's the friends I made. It was this incredible, magical network where you could just feel the love going from person to person, and we're all doing great, you know? And for me, it was like I was living the very thing I was seeing in the forest, and I just feel so much comfort. I know I'm going to be okay, and just like that tree is going to be okay as long as it stays within its community.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Suzanne Simard is a professor of forest ecology at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Now, across the world, at the University of Tel Aviv, botanist Daniel Shamovitz argues that plants can not only communicate, they can see, smell, feel, and remember. Not too long ago, he wrote a book called What a Plant Knows, which just might change the way you look at your garden. Steve Paulson reached him in Tel Aviv.
Danny, do we need a new model for how we understand the plant world?
I think we need to be much more appreciative of the complexity of plants, exactly how you said. You know, we sort of see them as unmoving, stationary objects. You know, we tend to relate to any organism that doesn't react like people do as something less than we are, when in actual reality, plants are incredibly complex. We can even say on some levels, they're more complex than people are, and we need to have an appreciation of that.
How are they more complex than people?
Well, for example, in terms of visual sensitivity, you know, we can see red, green, blue, you know, the rainbow, differentiate between light and dark. We have about 4 different photoreceptors in our bodies. Plants have upwards of 13 different photoreceptors. They see things we're blind to. From a plant's perspective, we're actually visually challenged.
Well, and you say that plants also can distinguish between colors. Why would they care what the color is?
Well, I don't think it's a question of caring, but how does a plant know when the end of day has come, when the night has begun? As the sun sets, we see the spectrum changing from white to yellow to red to a very dim red, which is called far red light. It's very far along the spectrum. This far red light is visible to the plant, and it signifies the beginning of night.
So I mean, we tend to talk about our own circadian clock. You're saying plants have their own circadian clock.
Of course, plants can go through jet lag. Literally, if you there are certain plants that open their leaves during the day and then close them at night. If you would take a potted plant like that, put it on an airplane, and if you would come from North America to Israel, its leaves would open at night and not during the day for the first few days. Now, when we study this, we don't put the plants on planes and send them around the world. We just have them in growth chambers where we can change when the lights go on and when the lights go off. But you can literally have a plant go through jet lag.
And you say plants also smell. I mean, obviously they don't have noses, yeah, but somehow they smell.
So here, let me just give you describe one of the stories or one of the things that's known to agronomists or plant growers for years. That, for example, in willow trees, if a willow tree is attacked by beetles, these willow trees, the leaves start giving off a chemical into the air, which is then picked up by the leaves of a neighboring tree. They smell it, we could say. And then when they absorb this chemical, when they smell the chemical, they start making other chemicals which become poisonous to the beetles. So in other words, they know how to protect themselves from the infestation. Now, this was a study that was published in the late 1970s, early 1980s. And when they were first published, this was like, you know, trees were screaming to each other, warning each other. But the facts are that there's some type of information being exchanged between trees, which we would call communication.
And I have to say, I mean, even just the very fact that once these signals go out, the ability then to respond, I mean, to release toxins, to repel the bug, I mean, that's pretty remarkable in its own right.
It is. I mean, so again, because we don't see trees talking to each other, we don't see trees moving, we tend to think of them as simple organisms, when in reality, they're incredibly complex genetically. Actually, most plants have more genes than animals do.
Do plants respond to touch?
Oh, sure. The most obvious example of a plant responding to touch would be the Venus flytrap. You know, if you've ever seen these movies, you know, of an open Venus flytrap and a fly landing on it, and it will wait until the fly is exactly in the middle, and only then it'll close.
So how does it do that?
Here's what's so amazing. It actually does it with the same mechanism that we do to a certain extent, through electricity. What happens when a fly lands on the Venus flytrap is that it touches two hairs, these two big black filaments in the center of the leaves. And when two of these hairs are touched, not one, but two, it causes an electric signal which radiates through the leaf, which causes it to snap very quickly shut, all in the absence of nerves and all in the absence of muscle. The basic cellular biology is the same.
Yeah. I mean, this is amazing what you've just said. So if just one of these hairs is touched, it's not going to close. There has to be a second one that touches. In other words, it has to remember that the other one has already been touched.
So there's so many different things happening in this process. One is it knows it's being touched. And second, it's remembering that the first one was touched, storing that memory until the second one is touched, recalling the information and then responding. You know, I call that short-term memory.
Do plants have long-term memory?
Yeah, and that's maybe even scarier because plants can store information and retrieve it over months, even years, and even through generations. Plants that have been exposed to some type of environmental stress, such as drought or heat, will then give rise to seeds, to progeny, who are more resistant to drought. It transfers that information from one generation to the other.
This is all pretty astonishing, I have to say.
It's amazing. Yeah. It's wonderful.
So given all that you've said, is it fair to call plants intelligent?
I don't even want to touch that with a 10-foot pole, and I'll tell you why. My wife's PhD was in educational psychology, and she was trying to define multiple intelligences. I started talking with you know, can I call plant intelligence? And she gave me this look of, you know, we can't even define for ourselves what intelligence is for humans. You want to talk about what it is for plants? You know, the great psychologist Gardner from Harvard, he's defined 12 intelligences so far, I think.
Right, multiple, you know, intelligences.
He says, okay, you want to call one vegetal intelligence? We can call, just give it a name and call it the 13th intelligence, the VQ. We can even make a test. We'll call it a VQ test. I think it's a moot point.
Let me rephrase the question another way. Okay. I mean, obviously plants don't have brains, but I'm wondering if this complex system of response to the environment that plants have, if that's somehow analogous to what a brain does.
Well, I think that makes us rethink what is a brain. And I think one of the most amazing things of plant biology is that a plant is acutely aware of both the temperature, the light environment, its age, the amount of water in the soil, what its neighbors are going through. And it integrates all of this information in the absence of a brain. So in other words, a plant has a unique mechanism which allows it to do calculations and to make decisions. So while a brain and a nervous system is an amazing evolutionary adaptation that allows decision making, plants have developed their own mechanisms, which we're only now starting to understand.
Steve Paulson talked with Daniel Shamovitz. He's the director of the Manna Center for Plant Biosciences at Tel Aviv University. You can read more in his book, What a Plant Knows. So now that we know plants can see, smell, touch, and communicate, can they also make music?
Welcome to a special exhibition recording of Data Garden Quartet, recorded live at the Philadelphia Museum of Art on April 13th through 15th, 2012. The music you're about to listen to was generated by four living plants. On lead synthesizer, a philodendron. On rhythm tone generator, Scheffler number one. Bass synthesizer, Scheffler number two. Controlling ambience and effects, snake plant. Produce this recording, electronic sensors were placed on plant leaves to measure conductive biorhythms in real time. These fluctuating rhythms were translated into data, allowing each plant to play a range of notes and textures assembled by a sound designer. At times, museum goers affected the compositions by touching and interacting with the plants. The combination of these dynamic interactions between plants, humans, and technology have resulted in this recording. While the means of producing this music can be described in technical terms, the natural creative force generating this experience is less apparent. We invite you to explore Data Garden Quartet while examining your own views on the source of its creation. Thank you.
Data Garden Quartet premiered at the Philadelphia Museum of Art and has toured the country. The group is currently working on a biorhythm to MIDI converter that will let anyone create music from houseplants. To hear and see more of their work, visit our website at ttbook.org. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. This hour, we're talking about the intelligence of plants. Of course, in Western culture, that's an oxymoron. Intelligence, according to the traditional definition, belongs to creatures with brains, not leaves. But when Steve Paulson sat down to talk with anthropologist Jeremy Narby, he told Steve about an intelligent single-celled amoeba.
My favorite, the slime mold Physarum polycephalum. Well, this is a peculiar single-celled organism. It usually behaves like a glistening mass of mucus that swarms over and engulfs its food. It's hardly a prime candidate for intelligence. But Japanese researchers, led by Toshiyuki Nakagaki and Hokkaido University, thought to put this blob-like organism into a miniature maze. And initially, this slime spread out and filled all the corridors of the maze. But when the researchers put food at the entrance and exit of the maze, the slime mold withdrew from the corridors that led to nowhere and reduced its body down to a tube spanning the shortest distance between food sources.
So the slime mold solved the maze.
The slime mold solved the maze. The slime mold, a single-celled piece of slime, somehow calculated the shortest distance between food sources. When Nakagaki published the results of his research in Nature, he used the word intelligence to describe the slime's behavior. He said there were two reactions to this. Western journalists and researchers mainly questioned the use of the word intelligence applied to this organism, whereas Japanese researchers and journalists mainly wanted to know how such an organism had managed to do this. He ascribed the difference between the two camps to the animist background of Japanese culture, Shintoist culture, and to the Japanese word for intelligence, which is chi-sei, chi meaning to know and sei meaning the capacity to know. Well, Japanese people do not hesitate to attribute a capacity to know to all kinds of creatures, including slime molds.
Well, let's take another example here, because this kind of intelligence, if that's the word we want to use, seems to extend beyond the animal world. I mean, plants respond to environmental conditions. I mean, there are, for want of a better word, sort of decisions to be made as to, you know, where you want to spread your roots.
Okay, well, there's a parasitic plant called dodder. And dodder lives off other plants, and it actually moves around at a speed that we can't perceive. But if you use speeded-up cameras, you see it feeling its way around. And what it does, it doesn't set down roots. It gauges the nutritional content of plants and then decides whether it should extract that nutritional content or move on. And it turns out, the scientists have looked into this, that the dodder's foraging strategies have the same mathematical correctness as those of animal foragers. But dodder does this without the benefit of a brain. How it does it is not clear, once again, but it does do it. In other words, if dodder runs into a plant that is not that interesting nutritionally, then it is simply going to move on. When it runs into a nice, juicy plant, then it sends in all these tendrils and starts extracting the juice. So, you know, I mean, there's that Clash song, should I stay or should I go? Well, essentially, that's what daughter's line of business, you know.
Is it fair to say that this plant has some sense of purpose?
Well, you know, one would have to speak with daughter, and you get daughter in here and do an interview, you know. I think purpose, the more I move forward with any of this, the more I think that each word has to be measured carefully.
Well, let me throw out another problematic word, consciousness. Uh-huh. Getting back to the slime mold and these daughter plants, mm-hmm. do they have consciousness?
So it has been said by quite a few people that only human beings have true consciousness. Well, if you've walked through Amazonian rainforest, as I have done with Ashaninka Indians, for example, and you come onto jaguar tracks, suddenly these Indians go really silent and they tell you to hush, and then they walk really fast to get out of there because they don't want to turn into cat food. And you can feel that when there is that feline intelligence lurking somewhere and maybe about to pounce on you and eat you, and you think, okay, only I have consciousness and this other animal does not have consciousness, you know that's baloney. It may not be human consciousness, but it's jaguar consciousness, and it's smart. The problem is it's at least as smart as we are. It's so smart that it's going to jump on you before you know it. And these are animals that are right at the top of the food chain. Nobody eats them, and they eat more or less anybody. And they're extremely discreet. I mean, scientists have never even seen jaguars give birth in the wild. So top of the food chain, but discreet. I mean, we could learn a lot of things from jaguar intelligence. And I think this would really be a step forward in human intelligence, is taking the intelligence of other species sufficiently seriously so that we could start to learn from them. But actually, you know, things are changing. There's a growing movement in biomimicry of people who have understood that there's actually even single cells are intelligent. Even proteins inside cells seem to behave with some kind of intelligence and yes, even purpose. So one can learn things from cells and from amoebas and from insects and trees, plants, weeds, blades of grass. These are all actually our cousins. If I go back in time, my parents, my grandparents, my great, and all the way back 2 billion years in time, and my direct ancestors are bacteria. So there it is. Every single life form on this planet is part of one family. It's our family.
Jeremy Narby is an anthropologist and author of the books Intelligence in Nature and The Cosmic Serpent. He talked with Steve Paulson. When Robin Wall Kimmerer was a little girl, her family spent summers canoe camping in the Adirondacks. Early mornings, when the sun was barely up, her father would make a pot of coffee on the Coleman stove, and each time, before he drank his first cup, he would stop, pour a thin stream of coffee on the ground, and say thanks to the spirits of the mountain. Robin is a member of the Potawatomi Nation. She grew up in a culture that considered the earth our mother, plants and animals our oldest teachers. Today, she's also an award-winning biologist and author of a book of essays called Braiding Sweetgrass. Robin, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Anne. Thanks for inviting me.
Of course. I really love that story about your father pouring the morning coffee on the ground. That was a regular ritual?
It was, absolutely, whenever we were out on the land, to start the day with Thanksgiving and, as you say, recognition of the gifts that are all around us. You don't take things for granted when you pause to say thank you.
And your story is typical of so many Native families' stories, you know, this break from the long tradition of culture. How did that happen in your own family?
Well, the break really began, well, there are so many historical steps to it, of course, but the one that is most poignant for me is that my grandfather, who was 9 years old on our Citizen Potawatomi Nation Reserve in Indian Territory, i.e. Oklahoma, was taken as a really young boy to east to the Carlisle Indian School, Whereas, you know, the mission of those boarding schools was total assimilation, to make people forget who they were, forget their ways of knowing, and replace them with those of the dominant culture. And so that was a really important break. And, you know, I remember as a kid asking my dad things about our culture, about our language, about ways of being. And he would just shake his head and say, you know, that was all left on the doorsteps of Carlisle Indian School. And so it has been a family practice and urge to reclaim and re-understand those ways of knowing.
How do you even go about doing that?
You know, because our history took us so far from our own people, some of my primary teachers of that kind of relationship were the plants themselves. I think I was born a botanist. You know, I just spent so much time in the woods looking at the way the world was put together, and really adopted that notion that they could teach me many of the things that had been lost by history. So that was kind of my early immersion, I suppose. But then as I grew older, and these great waves of cultural revitalization that are so powerful in Indian country today, we too became part of that wave of reclaiming and regenerating those things that had been lost.
You recently set out to learn the Potawatomi language yourself. How hard is that?
I found it an immense challenge, but also a great joy. And again, throughout Indian country, there is a wonderful language revitalization movement happening, so that even I, living remotely from my nation in upstate New York, I can sign on to, you know, an online language class from Oklahoma and study language in that way. There are immersion camps and all kinds of online resources, as well as the in-person connections that happen in community and at our tribal gatherings and classes.
Now, have you seen that closeness to the land, that different attitude toward nature, reflected in the Potawatomi language as you've begun to learn it? Are there words, for instance, that don't translate, that we don't have in English?
Absolutely. And these words capture the worldview that we have been talking about of the personhood of other beings. One of the words that really captivated me for the longest time was a word, papoi. And I happened on that word in a book by an Anishinaabe ethnobotanist, Kiweda Nokwe. And she talked about this wonderful word, and you know what it means. It means the force which causes mushrooms to push up out of the earth overnight.
Oh, the fact that's beautiful.
isn't it? When I learned that word, it reignited for me the longing for that lost language. If there was a people, if there was a thought system that contained a word for the life force of mushrooms, I wanted to learn it. And one of the things that has made my very rudimentary attempts at learning Potawatomi both beautiful and really challenging is the grammar. It contains what I would call the grammar of animacy.
Wow. Because what is that?
It's, you know, one of the best ways perhaps to say what it is to say at first what our native language, English, is not. You know how in English we refer to each other as persons, but if we referred to that maple tree outside our windows, we would have to refer to it in English as it. Mm-hmm. In English, you're either a human or you're an object. But in Potawatomi, this grammar of animacy means that we have the linguistic structure to speak of the living world as if it were alive, as if it was a person, as if it were our family, because in our way of thinking, it is. And isn't that, it's so interesting that in English, that has supported this, let's be honest, in many cases, a pretty exploitative way of thinking about the earth, as if it was just stuff, as if it was just a commodity. Well, that's what our language lets us do. It only lets us speak of water as if it was an it, not as if it was a who.
Does that mean, I don't know, if you're talking about the lake or the forest that you refer to it as he or she, or is it something more than that?
Well, it's not necessarily gendered. You know, our the Romance languages do have these cases for gendering. We'll say he or she. But in Potawatomi ways of speaking and thinking of the world, there's something for which there is no equivalent, really, in English. And that is the animate being who is not a human. And one of the things that really differentiates them, particularly in this idea that a worldview is embedded in the language, is that English is, I forget the percentages, but it's in the neighborhood of 60 to 70% of the words in English are nouns. Whereas that fraction is reversed in Potawatomi and Ojibwe, that they're verbs.
More of the language is verbs?
Is verbs, huh. Exactly. So, and this, so it conveys a world in motion, a right. world of animacy. Again, the things that we would say in English are a noun, like a stream. That's a noun, right? Well, no, it's a verb in Potawatomi, to be a stream. Because the water is alive. It conveys that notion that the world is alive and dynamic and always changing. And so a stream is not a static thing. It's a way of being. And so this struggle in converting your whole lens of looking at language from a noun-based to a verb-based language really captures that worldview of an animate universe.
What a beautiful notion. Oh, that's just gorgeous. That's something I'm taking away with me today. Thank you. So I'm curious, we alluded earlier, of course, to I think we all feel so much fear these days about the state of the planet, the future of the environment. Scientists tell us we've reached the point where we've done too much damage to retreat from. Where do you find hope?
I find hope in actually looking at many of those damaged places, which in fact show incredible resilience. Life wants to continue. And when we look at all the damage we've inflicted, it's easy to think that the earth has been broken, that the land is broken. But it's our relationship with land that's broken, and we have the power to change that. We can choose to consume with honor from the earth. We can choose to consume less. We can choose to understand the world as gift and respond accordingly. There are so many messages out there that make us feel like we're powerless, but each of us can choose the pathway of honorable consumption, of living with gratitude and reciprocity, and thereby create a transformative movement. I think that's what we need. Not more policy, not more data, not more money, but a change of heart.
Robin, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you, Anne. My pleasure.
Robin Wall Kimmerer is professor of environmental and forest biology at the State University of New York. Her collection of essays is called Braiding Sweetgrass. Coming up, another example of cross-species communication, this time between the political left and right. I'm Anne Strangeamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Now it's time for A Dangerous Idea.
I'm Charles Eisenstein, author of Sacred Economics, and my dangerous idea is that people don't actually base their beliefs on evidence and logic. Yet we act as if people do that in our efforts to persuade them, in our efforts to change their beliefs. Look at a liberal website and a conservative website. You'll find in the comments sections especially that both sides are saying pretty much the same thing. I mean, superficially, they're saying something quite opposite. But underneath that, they're in agreement that the reason that the other side doesn't agree is that they are intellectually or morally deficient. They are ignorant of the evidence. They are appalling people. They are stupid. They are close-minded or something like that. Both sides agree on this. But what if that's wrong? If that's wrong, then our attempts to change minds by using that kind of evidence-based logical argumentation may not work. So to give you an example from my own life, when I was in Taiwan as a young man, I went to see a Qigong master with a couple friends. And one of my friends asked, "Do you do acupuncture?" And he said, "Yes, but I don't use needles." And he kind of used his fingers as if he were holding a needle. And I felt something really distinctive and obvious happening to me. He did some other stuff, too, that was also very puzzling. And then he said, "Now I will open your channels." And he tapped us in a few places, walked out of the room, and almost instantly I was pouring sweat and feeling like someone had plugged me into an electrical circuit. And afterwards, walking out of there, I mean, this was evidence that contradicted my belief system. But did I change my mind and all of a sudden become a true believer in Qigong or energy fields or whatever? No. I said, "Well, you know, maybe he ran out of the room and turned up the heat real suddenly, and that's why I was sweating, or maybe I was just nervous." My belief system had a strong immune system. And along with that belief system was kind of this psychological identification with being right, being rational. And it was a little bit tragic, too. I think a lot of cynicism comes from the childhood betrayal of our perception of a magical living universe. So any kind of scientific anomaly or mystical teaching or even an experience that reawakens that perception is frightening, because what if it's betrayed again? You know, better ask for absolute proof. And how much proof is enough? No amount is enough, because we don't base our beliefs on evidence. There's always another story. It could be a fake, could be a hoax, could be made up. And how much money is this guy making from it?
That's Charles Eisenstein's Dangerous Idea. He's the author of Sacred Economics. For more Dangerous Ideas, check our website at ttbook.org. And now it's time for What's on Our Minds. This week, Ralph Nader is back in the news. The consumer advocate and former presidential candidate is pushing a new political agenda, cooperation. Nader's been getting together with another former presidential candidate from the opposite side of the political divide, Ron Paul. You can only imagine those conversations. Surprisingly, they've found some common ground. Nader describes it in his new book, Unstoppable: The Emerging Left-Right Alliance to Dismantle the Corporate State. In it, he describes 25 issues where left and right converge. He told Charles Monroe Kane, "People agree more than they realize."
What happens is that people are divided and ruled with labels and abstract ideologies. And when you bring the issues down where people live and work, then their sense of fair play kicks in. Their sense of, "Well, that's not right, that's not fair," their sense of the golden rule kicks in. For example, if you talk to people and say, "Are you for or against federal regulation of business?" you'll get the usual right-left split and disagreement. So then that's a sort of a general abstraction. Then you go down to where people live and you say, "Do you have a car?" "Yeah." "What if the auto company found a deadly defect in the car after it sold it to you and doesn't want to recall it? Do you think the federal government should regulate that and require the recall?" Well,
yeah,
you know,
there you go. Consensus.
You know what I mean? Same with safe food, safe drugs, clean air and water for their kids. And that's what we're trying to do in this book, is to make very clear with documentation this emerging swell of left-right that basically can form the most practical political realignment to get things done in this country. People are really frustrated by gridlock and paralysis. To me, I don't see anything on the horizon other than this political realignment. And the interesting thing about it is it doesn't really focus on elections. It just focuses on the incumbents and basically says to the incumbents, hey, there's a tidal wave heading toward Washington here of demands, and they're coming from left and right. You better shape up because you may ship out.
You know, it's interesting. You know, recently we've had the Tea Party, and the Tea Party did kick a bunch of people out and got in under a more populist ideals. But it seems like when they got into the gridlock of the Beltway, nothing happened to them other than I think they're not going to get reelected.
Yeah.
That seems like that is certainly indicative of what I think does happen, though, when you enter into the system.
Yeah, well, what happened is the corporatists and the corporate lobbies hijacked the Tea Party effort. And so became popular, and so you had some right-wing corporatist Republicans just putting their Tea Party label right on themselves. And I think they hijacked it because the citizens back home who called themselves Tea Partiers, you couldn't stereotype them. I mean, somebody...
No, they're all over the place.
Yeah, some of them were a little racist. But others were just libertarians who just didn't like empire. They didn't like wars of aggression. They didn't like corporate welfare, subsidies, handouts, bailouts of Wall Street. That sort of had the original inspiration of the Tea Partiers. Now, there are other things, you know, that they didn't like that would never be part of this left-right convergence. But it really is quite extraordinary to see that if you have major public opinion behind you, it doesn't take more than 1% of the people of this country focused on Congress in a serious way to get some change.
I have a question, and to get back to being practical, one of your 25 convergences that you talk about, which are very fascinating, is with taxes. And I thought to myself, can the far left and the far right really agree on an issue so simple as taxes? It seems like there's such a divide there. Practically, how was there a convergence on that issue?
Well, there's a lot of convergence. And one is the left and right don't like these corporations going to the Bahamas or other tax havens and escaping their fair share of taxation. That's unfair. It's a double standard. There are major corporations in this country that have made billions of dollars and pay no federal income tax, like General Electric or Verizon in recent years. Or there are the big banks, and they're lucky if they pay 2% or 5%. Well, you know what a worker pays. I mean, they pay anywhere from 15, 20, 25.
Yeah, I don't pay 2%.
Yeah,
I pay a lot more
than that. And so there's that part. The other part is there's growing left-right support for a Wall Street speculation tax. Uh-huh. Now, people in this country, they go into a store and they buy necessities, and they pay 6, 7, sometimes 8% sales tax. Well, today, someone can buy on Wall Street $100 million of ExxonMobil derivatives and pay nothing. And so one half of 1% sales tax on these huge, high-volume, high-velocity trades, especially derivatives, can produce $300 billion a year with a B. And you see, that can build a lot of public works in our country and create a lot of jobs.
You know, I can see, like, my conservative uncle and my dad and my liberal sister agreeing on certain things about corporate welfare and corporate problems. But I can see very quickly with social issues and with other issues, it just completely falling apart and turning it into an argument. I can see a breakfast with you and Ron Paul hanging out, and I can see you could agree on a lot, you know, cutting the defense budget, at least auditing it, corporate issues. But I can see a lot of other problems. How do you, with this alliance, how do you guys agree to disagree? That sounds complicated.
Right from the beginning, we say, look, Ron Paul and me, we're going to disagree on full Medicare for all. Ron Paul's never going to agree to that, and I'm never going to agree with him on that. And I'll say, Ron Paul, you and I disagree on a need for strong health and safety regulation. He's never agree on that. So let's put all those to one side, okay? All right, what do we agree on? We agree on opposing corporate subsidies and bailouts, government aid to dependent corporations, so to speak. We agree that our empire abroad has got to be pulled back. We're getting into a lot of trouble overseas. It's costing taxpayers trillions. It's costing American soldiers lives and disability. We also agree that the trade agreements shred too much U.S. sovereignty. We've ceded our legislative and regulatory and judicial sovereignty to, you know, this secret tribunal, literally, under the World Trade Organization, Geneva, Switzerland. He definitely agrees in curtailing the power of the Federal Reserve, which I think is way, way beyond its proper legal authority. And he would like to break up the big banks that are now smaller in number after the Wall Street crash, or maybe six of them, too big to fail, too big to jail. And as George Will, the conservative columnist, has said, if a big bank is too big to fail, it's too big to exist.
Yeah.
Now, that's a lot, Charles, that's a lot of area of agreement.
Sure.
And it reflects the public opinion.
It seems to me that the American people have lost their moxie. Do you see that? Have you seen a change in the last 40 years?
Yeah, you put your finger on it. The biggest obstacle to the American people getting their way for a better country for their descendants and around the world is their self-declared powerlessness. They give up on themselves. They grow up without any civic experience and civic skills and taught in the schools. They don't have any civic experience. They don't know hardly what's going on in their hometown and city. And that spells low voting turnout, a lot of withdrawal from politics, and powerlessness. And so you put your finger on it. The sense of induced powerlessness in a country where the Constitution starts with we the people, not we the corporation, is the main problem to get over with. And I think more people will get that moxie back when they see that it's not their just their political persuasion supporting them. It's the other side that's supporting them as well.
You know, if I had come from Mars and observed America through the media, the news media and a bunch of people, politicians, I would say that we are cynical. I would say that we're dystopian. And I would say that we're extremely negative. I hear you talk and I read your book. And this surprises me from what I think you would know of all the years of doing this. You're extremely optimistic, borderline utopian. Why aren't you cynical about this stuff?
Because when I was at Princeton, I was a little down with this state of the country. You know, it was Soviet Union, U.S., missiles, Joe McCarthy. And so I went into the library and I wanted to study the philosophers of pessimism, starting with Schopenhauer. And I did study them and I realized that there is no function to pessimism. There's no purpose to it other than it drains you of your own human potential to do good in the world. So I just abolished it. That's just like that. And that makes you much more resilient and much less likely to be discouraged, much more likely to make your last defeat or your last mistake your best teacher.
And you can be left or right to abolish pessimism from your life, right?
Sure.
That's veteran consumer advocate and former presidential candidate Ralph Nader talking with Charles Monroe Kane. Nader's new book is called Unstoppable: The Emerging Left-Right Alliance to Dismantle the Corporate State. And that's it for this hour, but there's more online. Photos, videos, books, and links are all on our website at dtbook.org. Or you can join the conversation on our Facebook page. Search for To the Best of Our Knowledge. This show comes together every week thanks to the hard work of our producers, Doug Gordon, Charles Monroe Kane, Sarah Nix, Raymond Tungekar, and Stephanie Youngblood. Kirill Owen makes us sound good, and Steve Paulson keeps us all in line. I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for spending time with us.
PRI, Public Radio International.